Good day, and welcome to the Food Waste Webinar 5. Today's webinar is being recorded. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the webinar over to Gary Freinland. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Deanne. Welcome, everyone, to our fifth and final food waste webinar, brought to you by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Region 2 and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation in partnership with the Solid Waste Resource Renewal Group at the Rutgers, New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station. I'm Gary Feinlands with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and I'll be introducing today's webinar and speakers. The webinar series is designed to provide tips and tools for food waste generators, and we're happy to have you all participating today. Today's webinar is entitled Making Compost Happen, Putting Together the Pieces. It will feature presentations on what decisions to consider in order to be able to divert food waste to composting and some tools to help with the decision-making process. Before I introduce today's speakers, I'll turn the line over to Amy Wolfram to go over some of the call logistics. Amy?
Thanks, Gary. Hello, everyone. My name is Amy Wolfram, and I'm with ICF International, and I'm a contractor for the EPA. The first thing I'd like to let you know is that this is a recorded session. If you have problems to connecting to the webinar, please call 1-877-807-0970. And additionally, if you are unable to hear the audio portion, there is a number on the opening slide. The slides will be moved for you, and there may be up to a 10-second delay as they transfer through. If you're listening through your computer speakers and you hear an echo during the webinar, turn down your computer volume. Note, in order to listen by the phone line, you must call via the phone. You must call the phone number and enter the participant code assigned to you when you registered for the webinar. This was also sent to you in a reminder email earlier today and also last week. Note, there'll be a several-second delay as we transition between speakers. We encourage questions from you all, and we ask that you note them in the Q&A log, which at the top of your screen is the fourth tab over. If you click on that Q&A button, you're able to ask a question. We're holding all of our questions till the end of the presentations. If you have a question for a particular presenter, it's best to put that presenter's name in front of your question before you, as you enter it into the Q&A log. For example, if you have a question for Nora, please say, Nora, I have a question about X. So that is what I have as far as logistics. Gary, would you like to introduce today's speakers?
Sure. Today we have three wonderful speakers lined up. Nora Goldstein from BioCycle, Steve Sherman of Cascadia Consulting Group, and Jennifer Brady with the U.S. EPA Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. Our first speaker, Nora Goldstein, is editor of BioCycle, the magazine for advancing composting, organics recycling, and renewable energy published by the JG Press, Inc. in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. BioCycle celebrated its 50th anniversary in 2009. Nora has authored numerous articles on all facets of composting and organics recycling, and more recently, anaerobic digestion. She has edited a number of books and other publications and has served on numerous solid waste and biosolids recycling advisory committees. Nora oversees and works on BioCycle national surveys, including the state of garbage in America and the food composting infrastructure in the United States. Nora?
Hello, everybody, and thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you all this afternoon. For those of you who have been participating in the entire series, you have certainly seen the entire spectrum of what goes into organics recycling and specifically food waste diversion. And what I hope to do today is to really focus in on the fact that food waste composting happens. It's going on. It's in full swing. It's been going on for a number of years, and we're really seeing a rapid increase in on both ends, on the generators who are interested or already actively pursuing diversion of their food waste streams to composting and increasingly, in some cases in areas, anaerobic digestion. And we'd like to say that that pump is really primed for diversion on the part of the generators. And on the other end, we're really seeing a number of interesting projects from really large full-scale centralized facility to smaller local operations, decentralized operations. And in between connecting those streams, the commercial institutional to the processor, is a host of interesting collection hauling services, as well as trainers, different people in the business of really making all this happen. And I'm going to focus today on both residential and commercial initiatives, commercial being what we call ICI, institutional, commercial, industrial. And I'm just going to launch right in. And what I just want to say, because I won't remember to at the end, up here you see the BioCycle website. Just about every project that I'm going to discuss has been written up in BioCycle. And if you go to this website and search on that particular project, an article probably will come up, if not more than one. And many of those articles you can download for free. If you're a subscriber, you can download them all that way. So what are we talking about? I'm sure you've seen plenty of pictures of the feedstocks that typically go into effective food waste composting operations. So in the upper left, you have the food waste, which is really not just the food portion. It typically comes with, especially in the commercial institutional side, with papers, soiled paper, non-recyclable wax corrugated, and a host of other compostable yet not edible materials. And then you have yard trimmings. And then the other ingredient that oftentimes is very beneficial to composting food waste, which is very wet and putrescible and dense, is wood chips. Put all that together, compost it, and you end up with a really nice, high-value product that increasingly is being used by a really wide range of markets. This is just another shot. I'm sure you've seen a million of these in the course of these webinars. And typically, especially for aerated static pile and outdoor windrow, these materials, which tend to break down pretty quickly, if any of you do home composting and have a kitchen counter container, gets very liquidy in a hurry, they tend to make a bed out of the bulking agent, the ground yard trimmings and wood, and then tip into that and then mix everything up together. The bio there, Gary mentioned BioCycle's food composting infrastructure survey. It was conducted in the second half of 2008, and we identified 267 food waste composting projects in the U.S. that included colleges, universities, commercial composters, farms, and municipalities that are taking food waste streams, both residential and commercial institutional. We are doing an update to the survey in 2010, and just by tracking projects around the country and in North America and actually around the world, we are definitely expecting that number to be much, not hundreds and hundreds more, but for sure we're well beyond the 300 mark. This is just a map of the U.S. and shows the darker colors are where there's darker greens are where there are more projects, lighter colors or white is where there are few or none. What I'm going to just go through initially are some of the collection programs, not describing collection as much as to show you the variety and then where that ends up going in terms of projects. But one thing that we're seeing on the residential side, in areas where there is not year-round green waste generation and collection, is an organics-only dedicated curbside bin. This is an example of a 13-gallon one used in Ontario. This particular company recently introduced a 20-gallon version that can actually be unloaded with a tipper. So if there is a three-stream program, all card-based, you can do that. The concept here is that during the yard trimming seasons, the spring and the fall, typically more the fall in certain parts of the U.S., you do bulk collection of leaves, but other times of the year you don't have as much. So this, from a processing capacity standpoint and other considerations, is a trend that we expect to see more of. There's a lot of this going on in Ontario and a few other places in eastern Canada, whereas in the U.S., you tend to see the bulk of the programs taking residential organics, typically collected in a yard waste, green waste type cart. They're doing regular collection curbside of the yard trimmings, and food and soil paper gets added into that. That's primarily what you see on the West Coast for residential. This is, again, what you see in terms of more on the kitchen side, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of this over the course of the slides, and I think Steve will probably get into some of this, but these are just examples of what happens in restaurant kitchens, cafeterias. And this is kind of a cool example. This just we wrote up in the March issue of BioCycle, but there's a restaurant chain called Burgerville in the Pacific Northwest, and they have really been part of what they are, who they are. Their brand is being sustainable and green. And they've recently introduced the compostable cups, and by doing this, this is the last piece of what it takes for Burgerville to have basically an entirely compostable stream on the what their service ware. And I believe, I don't know if all the restaurants are on composting at this point, but I would probably guess that the majority are. This is just an example in Central Vermont Solid Waste District where you saw those toters in an earlier slide. This is, in many cases, those toters get picked up and tipped into a packer-type truck. In this instance, the toters actually are taken to the composting site, emptied, cleaned, and returned. But this is just a visual examination of what's in that cart looking for contaminants. What I really want to focus on in the rest of my time is what we call the many degrees of food waste composting. And what's important, and if the biggest message I want to impart this afternoon, is that we often hear that there is a lot of the pump is primed on the generation side, but the infrastructure to take these materials is insufficient. And while on a macro level nationally, I think that's probably accurate. On a micro level within regions and communities, we're trying to really start to work through that perception and really look at how to change behavior, starting perhaps at a very small scale, gradually ramping up the amount of food waste diverted, until you ramp up to the full-scale facility. So what I'm going to do is start with the most, aside from home composting, sort of the next step up that we're starting to see in a lot of communities, and this is particularly exciting because most of these community gardens are neighborhoods that the population in that neighborhood has very limited access to fresh foods, and these programs typically are community urban farms that do receive food scraps primarily from restaurants and compost it, use the compost to grow the fruits and vegetables. In turn, the community has access to that. It provides jobs. This particular organization, Added Value, in New York City, has a farm in Red Hook, and they are taking in a decent amount of source-separated food waste in this program. And if you really just poke at this particular niche a little bit, you're going to find that many, many communities are doing this, and this is extremely exciting, both socially, economically, and from a sustainable waste management perspective. This is a little bump up from there. This is an article that we had on a particular technology, but this is Toyota Motor Manufacturing in Kentucky. This is what is in their food service areas, their cafeterias, and they installed this rotary drum, and this article is a bit dated. I think it's 2 years old now, but at the time that we ran it, the drum cost about $90,000, and the avoided tip fees for Toyota were about $250,000 a year. The other thing that's really important to mention with the community farms, with these in the workplace and also schools, is that you establish a behavior either at the workplace or the school or in the garden of really illustrating source separation. People do it. It's just what they start to do, and that's really how we have to build this change in behavior, because to really optimize food waste diversion and have a high-quality compost, you do need to source separate. This is the next degree up. This is a company in New Jersey called Ag Choice. They actually started out in they're a sawmill, and they were selling sawdust to horse farms in the area. The horse farms had an issue with managing the horse manure, the bedding, and so they started collecting it in these dumpster type things that they would leave at the farms, and gradually they serviced some supermarkets in the area, taking only the vegetative stream, and they incorporate that in a very low tech. It's a windrow. There's a turn windrow there. They use the pile covers, but really not a high technology, fairly small footprint to make food waste composting happen. You may have seen this in last week's webinar, or winter, maybe 2 weeks ago, with Bob Spencer, because he worked on this project. But the example here, this is Rocky Hill Farms in just about 15 miles north of Boston. It's a farm operation that takes source-separated commercial institutional organics from the city of Boston, and they ran into a real capacity issue doing just open windrows, also some odor issues, leachate, and they basically built this drum themselves. They took a used drum and refurbished it, and not only does this address some of their environmental issues, but it also significantly increased their site capacity because the materials break down more quickly in that drum, so they can process more material. And it was not a huge capital investment. Again, fairly low-tech, but very effective. This is another example, McEnroe Farms in New York State. This is what I was saying about building the bed to receive the materials. Then the food waste, yard trimmings, bulking agent gets put in enclosed bags for about 3-4 weeks, and then is moved to a composting pad. McEnroe Farms has a very high-end compost market for their products, and so contamination is a big issue for them. I know there have been some challenges, and I haven't checked in with them in a while, but wanted to show you that sort of next bump up from Ag Choice. City of Hutchinson, Minnesota, is an example of a municipal facility that early on started back probably almost 10 years ago doing residential source-separated organics in these vessel containers here, created a nice composting niche, started taking in yard trimmings, which they compost outdoors. But what has really shifted for them is the fact that they have an entity called Creekside Soils, and they are a significant supplier of compost products, blends, in bags to that region. And what's interesting is the market success with the compost is actually now driving their need for more feedstock, and they hope to be signing on some commercial generators in the very near future. This, now we're getting into the really bumped up sophisticated source-separated organics composting facilities. This is McGill in Sussex, Virginia. McGill is a composting company on the East Coast, primarily in the North Carolina, Virginia area. And this shows when you start getting to a certain scale, very important to manage odors, leachate, and other things. And so in this particular instance, they have a lot more capacity than the other facilities, but it's obviously a much more significant capital investment. But it allows them to service a very wide range of generators. And I believe they've started servicing the Metro Washington area with collection and diversion of organics. This is a brand new, it's probably the newest centralized composting facility to start up. I believe it started taking materials in the winter and has been gradually ramping up. This is Peninsula Composting in Wilmington, Delaware. Interesting here, this facility is fairly close to, it's in an industrialized area of the city of Wilmington, but there are residences very close by. There was a desperate need for composting capacity in this Philadelphia, Southern Jersey region. I believe, and I apologize for this, I believe it scaled at 500 tons a day. I may be a bit off on that, but again, state-of-the-art using a covered aerated static pile composting technology. A lot of processes taking place inside that building so they can treat the air for odors. This is one of the largest composting sites. This one is in outside of Seattle, Washington, Cedar Grove Composting. They use a similar technology, the same technology as Peninsula, but have a bit of a smaller receiving building, which and what's interesting is projects that come after pioneers know where they might have to tweak to make their operations easier. Cedar Grove recently expanded this receiving area and put more automated doors on it. And what's exciting here is they are looking, and I believe probably pretty soon will be announcing a selection of an anaerobic digestion technology provider for dry fermentation, so they'll do a first stage of anaerobic digestion and then be able to accelerate the composting process and also generate valuable biogas. This is a facility, Jepson Prairie, owned by Recology. It handles San Francisco source-separated organics and materials from a few other places, but the top photo shows their operations similar to those bags that McEnroe Farm uses and then into open windrows. But California, if as many of you know, has some very, very strict air emissions requirements that are being drafted or are in place. And composting facilities, in order to operate in the state in an open configuration like this, really can get limited on the amount of feedstocks, food waste feedstocks they can take. And so very recently, and I think it's still, in a startup mode, Jepson Prairie installed this cover aerated static pile system and is, going, like I say, that transition is, if it's completed, it's just very recently completed. But what it will do is enable them to take more quantities of food waste and meet those emissions limits. Many of you probably know that San Francisco and Recology have been very aggressively exploring anaerobic digestion as a first stage for composting. They've been working with East Bay Municipal Utilities District. EPA Region 9 has an excellent fact sheet on that if you're interested in learning more. And we'll know from our conference coming up next week, there'll be a presentation on additional plans for anaerobic digestion capacity in that area. This then is the very last iteration and really not a facility designed for food waste composting solely. This is the Delaware County, New York mixed waste composting facility. But I just wanted to put this in here as a comparison, if you will. You can see that all enclosed operation and facilities like this has the agitated bay set up, could also, and I think they may be taking in source-separated organics as well. My last set of slides are covering and the anaerobic digestion piece. Increasingly, there is interest in diverting source-separated food waste streams to farm digesters and centralized digesters for anaerobic digestion for energy production. Typically, these food waste streams, and as well as fats, oils, grease, have much higher biogas production capability than straight manure does, dairy manure, for example. And when this is added to the digesters, it breaks down fairly quickly, so it's not using that much capacity, but it's a significant boost to the biogas production and creates a tip fee situation for the dairy farmers, which is always a plus. This is an example up in Ontario. This is another option, and this is what Recology is, you know, pursuing with the East Bay Municipal Utility District in Oakland. This is a much small-scale version of that, but wastewater treatment plant digesters are becoming equipped to take not just fats, oils, and grease, but also source-separated and slurried food waste streams. This is the City of Toronto. This is an old picture of their anaerobic digester. This is just an example of a dedicated centralized digester. I would say about a year from now, there will be, you know, the 3-4 projects operating in North America, maybe 5, that are strictly designed to take municipal commercial organics into an anaerobic digestion system, typically followed by composting. This is a wet system, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, sorry about that, is going to be putting in a pilot-scale dry fermentation system. We expect to see some of those being implemented in some larger cities in the near future. One thing I just want to emphasize, and I'm sure you've heard a lot about this over the webinars, is the significant importance of outreach and education. The top photo is just a picture of a Recology truck that picks up the source-separated organic stream of the city of San Francisco. They really want to hit home the full cycle. In the lower corner is a restaurant proudly displaying its participation in a composting program. And one of my favorite BioCycle covers is our December 2009 issue, where we had our residential food waste composting survey report, and the whole cover is just really fun outreach and education materials. About 3 years ago, BioCycle, working with the Biodegradable Products Institute, started a searchable database called findacomposter.com. Right now we have close to 400 facilities, composting facilities in the U.S., many of them taking food waste. This is a publicly searchable database with no fee to list or search. It is, entries are verified by BioCycle editors, and then the information goes up there for use. We set a goal of populating that database with 1,000 facilities by January 2011, and if anybody on this call is a composter or knows of a composting facility that is not in Find a Composter, we really hope that you encourage them to sign in. The state of Ohio, I think, is one of the states that really has taken the lead from a regulatory standpoint on encouraging food scraps composting. Both within their regulations. Over the last few years, a number of sites have been permitted to add food waste to existing yard trimmings composting sites. This is a huge opportunity for infrastructure. There's, in some states, some regulatory hesitation, yet I think Ohio is showing that is possible, and this is just a map of where these facilities are within the state. Again, very important for outreach and education. I'd like to end with this slide, because this is really, at the end of the day, you know, composting is a waste management tool, but composting is also a resource creation tool. And this was a eureka that the grounds managers at Harvard University had on how compost actually really, really, really helps their turf. And they have the famous Harvard Yard. and they experimented using compost as a top dressing a few times and now plan to roll it out to all the green areas there. So composting, food waste composting is happening. It's been happening for a long time, and use of high-quality compost is what really closes that loop. And look forward to your questions, and I'll just go to my contact information if you don't get an opportunity to have your question answered today. Thank you.
Thanks, Nora. Your presentation really showed how robust composting and digestion is in this country. That was great. Our next speaker is Steve Sherman. Stephen Sherman is a pioneer and established leader in municipal food and yard waste management. He serves as senior manager for Cascadia Consulting Group and was president of Applied Compost Consulting Incorporated from 1992 to 2005. Mr. Sherman has worked extensively planning and implementing municipal organics programs for the commercial and residential sectors, including projects with the City of San Francisco, Alameda County Waste Management Authority in California, the City of Portland, Oregon, the Houston-Galveston Area Council, U.S. Agency for International Development, and the U.S. EPA Region 9. Mr. Sherman recently completed, in collaboration with others, an EPA-supported guidebook for organics recovery from the residential sector. Stephen earned a master's in agricultural and resource economics from Cornell University and a bachelor's degree from Yale College. Stephen?
Thank you, Gary. Hello, everybody. I'm thrilled and honored to be on a panel with representatives from BioCycle and the EPA. Today, I'll be discussing some of the opportunities and decision points for advancing from municipal scale yard trimmings composting to include food scraps and other materials. I do want to say about BioCycle and EPA that without these organizations' leadership, composting as a widespread municipal solid waste management technique would not have come as far as it has and will go. Nora's family at BioCycle were my original sources of information and inspiration when I was researching the economics of large-scale composting as a graduate student in the 1980s at Cornell. BioCycle is an incredible source, as you heard Nora speak. Similarly, EPA's regulation of landfills in the 1970s and 80s paved the way for the growth of municipal composting of yard trimmings in the 1990s. And EPA's recent official findings about the harmfulness of greenhouse gases will help to propel greater interest in food waste composting in the new decade. Okay. So you've probably heard, if you've been on other webinars in this series, discussions about how many tons of materials there are. So this is just going to be a quick review of that. Roughly 30 million tons, a bit more, of food scraps estimated to have been disposed as of 2007. A small fraction of that, perhaps 3%, is diverted, most of that via composting. And as we've learned in recent years, methane is a potent greenhouse gas, and food scraps certainly create methane in landfills. Now, my discussion today is actually really mostly about composting. So I'm discussing near the bottom of the hierarchy of food discards management. And as you see from this slide, you see that there are many other techniques, policy measures, components of a comprehensive organics program that are higher on the hierarchy, source reduction, feeding hungry people, feeding animals, so on, before composting. So I do want to at least make that caveat, or at least to put in place where we actually are when we're talking about composting. The materials that we're primarily looking at, food scraps, yard trimmings, clean scrap wood, compostable, non-recyclable paper. You'll notice in that list the word waste does not appear. So where do we begin? So I'll be looking at some of the key drivers and what motivates communities to look at, I may be using the term food scraps or organics, largely When I'm referring to food scraps, I am talking about food scraps plus soiled paper and so on. We'll be looking at some of the success indicators, and we'll talk a bit about which sector you might consider starting with, whether residential or commercial, or is sometimes called ICI. So the drivers, regulatory drivers, are there restrictions on the disposal of targeted materials? Are there requirements for achieving certain levels of recycling or diversion from disposal facilities? Those are some of the questions to be asking. Regulation certainly is a key driver. Environmental factors include greenhouse gases, landfill leachate from wet materials in landfills, limited landfill capacity, soil production needs, and a whole host of additional environmental factors. Some of the economic and social factors, of course, are rising disposal fees on the economic side, on the social side, higher support for local environmental solutions, and a whole host of additional factors. So this slide, what motivates communities already is already a fairly long list, and I'm sure we could add some additional ones. Talk about a couple of these ones briefly. So costs are an issue, costs are an opportunity. So looking at longer-term disposal cost savings, looking at avoided costs, that can help communities. Preserving landfill capacity has certainly been a motivator for some. We're seeing with whether it's stimulus funds for supporting anaerobic digestion or just more generally the support of recycling and reuse programs and composting programs as a jobs creator. Some communities have climate change goals that's beginning to motivate stronger interest in composting. We have anywhere from large hotels to wastewater facility operators that want to reduce the concentration, the amount of food scraps and fats, oils, and grease that are going through the pipes, and that's been a motivator as well. Overall demand for green services is increasing, as of course are laws and regulations, and the huge educational value that goes into coupling composting programs with recycling programs and leading into other environmental messaging. So success indicators. When we're talking about large-scale composting, these are some of the main ones that you might look at. Some communities may be collecting other ones as well. Looking at the amount of material collected, usually in terms of tons per year. I think I tend to side, like I know that Nora does as well, on the material quality sides. Quality counts, the either the percent contamination, the amount of non-recoverable, non-compostable materials. That's a number that matters, as is the quality of the end product. I tend toward looking first and foremost at creating high-quality products, figuring that high-quality products really is the backbone of a sustainable system. Greenhouse gas reductions measured in typically in carbon dioxide equivalents, and then the overall cost per ton of collection, processing, marketing. These are the indicators for composting. If we were looking at some of the other things that were on the hierarchy of what to do with discarded food, For industrial uses of food scraps, for instance, we might look at the amount of energy produced or the dollar value of industrial products created. For feeding rescued food to hungry people, we'd use other indicators such as the number of meals served per year to hungry elderly people and the number of meals that food pantries provided the means to serve to hungry children. Did I just miss one? Nope. Okay, here we are. Hold on, just looking for my spot here. Okay, so residential organics program. So I'm going to talk both about residential and commercial programs. I would say three of the more successful models to look at are in Alameda County in Northern California, which borders on San Francisco, and then King County, Washington, where Seattle is. Nearly all King County residents have access to food scraps and organics collection, and there's slightly under 2 million residents in King County. All Alameda County residents have access to food scraps collection, and Alameda County has slightly under 1.5 million residents. Some of the cities in Alameda County, Oakland, Berkeley, Livermore, Fremont, those are some of the cities in Alameda County, and that's where I live. So Alameda County has 16 participating cities. King County, if I have this number correct, has 28, so close to 30. And so roughly half of the cities that in the U.S. that are doing residential organics, so food scraps recovery, roughly half of the cities in the U.S. that BioCycle found in a recent survey are from those two counties, Alameda County and King County. And this is similar to the findings from the survey that's part of the EPA study that I co-authored with an earlier speaker in this series regarding residential organics. What's interesting is that we do have a few mature residential organics regions in the country, namely the San Francisco Bay Area and the Seattle metropolitan area, that we can draw inspiration and experience from as we develop programs throughout the country. On the logistics side of things, you see the question here of, well, how do we collect this stuff? Should we collect food scraps and food soil paper with co-collect it with yard trimmings? Should we collect it separately? Should we send it down the sewer system? These are questions that have to be worked out in each community. In San Francisco, you've probably heard quite a bit about this program. I want to talk just quickly about some of the origins of this program. In the mid-1990s, I was involved with writing an organics management plan, a comprehensive plan for the city, which went into all different aspects of organics recovery, included such things as discussing how to expand their home composting program, providing grants from the solid waste management program to agencies that rescue edible food, support for community groups that develop community gardens, not discouraging urban food scraps such as beer brewery waste from being diverted directly to farms. So all at the same time while developing plans for large-scale composting. There was a pilot program in the late 1990s which led into the Fantastic Three residential collection program. So we tested out a number of different methods for recovering food scraps. There was a period of rate restructuring that the city went through. There was a phased rollout. I think it was 5 years, 3 to 5 year rollout, as I recall, earlier in the OO decade. There was a high level of education, outreach, and publicity on a sustained basis over a number of years. Over time, multifamily food scraps recovery was added. And now, most recently, there is a requirement for separating food scraps from trash. Now, that came into being, that requirement of source separation came into being roughly 10 years after the initial pilot programs. How did this end up working? A combination of vision, commitment, the infrastructure, and the expectation that the road to excellence may have curves on it, but it's possible for you, for all of us, to get there. So I'm going to make a case. Now, this is a bit of an overstatement, but I do want to at least I was asked to try to narrow this down of, so which sector would we start with? And, of course, the answer is it depends. But let me at least make the case of why one would start with the commercial sector. So this is just one small example here of a large popular restaurant generating a large amount of food scraps compared to a household that generates a small amount of food scraps. And I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations where we had, say, a community with 100,000 population, half of whom are in single-family homes, let's say, and from that you derive some participation factor and set-out factors, and it comes down to where what I've seen from different communities is that it's possible to get as much tonnage of food scraps from, say, 200, 300 businesses in a city of 100,000, let's say, to get the same amount from 200 or 300 businesses as one might expect to get of food scraps from the residential sector. It's one thing if you've already got weekly residential collection of yard trimmings year-round in containers. You might start with residential food scraps. It's another thing to deal with residential food scraps if you've got, say, seasonal collection of leaves using a vacuum truck. And in that case, commercial might be easier to start with if you're deciding how do we move beyond just residential yard trimmings collection and maybe some commercial drop-off of yard trimmings. Okay, so primary West Coast programs. San Francisco is by far and away the leader here, both in terms of the recovery rate and the number of businesses involved. San Mateo County is a program I've worked with. It's also borders San Francisco. It's just south of it. It's all suburban. It has a very high recovery rate. Then you see a number of other cities. These are the West Coast examples. The rate in Seattle right now is probably much higher than what's reported here. This is data from a few years ago. So how do we get started with, if you're a local government, on a source-separated organics program? So I'm going to walk through these steps here pretty quickly. Take a look at other programs. There are very good models out there. All the programs have something that I think could be of interest, and you'll find something that will work in your community by developing something that's tailored locally. Developing an action plan is essential. You really need to have a sense of what are the steps that you're going to take, how are you going to get there. Looking at the infrastructure, do we have facility capacity? Do we have a way of making sure that collection is going to happen? Do customers have the appropriate collection mechanisms? You see the other ones here, assessing the product markets and choosing your hauler. Setting the incentives is crucial. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. Having an effective outreach strategy, launching the program, that's, I'm a big fan of starting small, doing pilot programs, testing things out over, 6 months, a year, something like that, tweaking the program and moving forward. documenting and analyzing the results are part of effective program planning as well. So on the incentive structure, everyone needs an incentive. That's the participants, the haulers, and the processors. I've seen programs where participants get a cost differential of 25 to 75% lower than the cost of the trash service. The haulers need to be incentivized to collect. They need to be paid to meet public policy goals. Contracts need to be structured appropriately. In terms of haulers, what I've seen is that, you know, haulers are very, very good at picking up materials. They're not set up to be experts at education and outreach. Haulers need the assistance of professionals to provide the type of education and outreach that involves going into businesses and really working with the nitty-gritty of where do we place internal collection containers, how do we train people at certain times of day and night, and so on. That's a whole subject for another presentation. That we've seen that type of technical assistance and outreach as a hallmark of some of the more successful programs. There are, as we know, a lot of permitting hurdles. It can be an expensive and time-consuming process. And yet it is still possible to move forward. Okay, I have a couple more slides here. I'm not going to go into all the siting hurdles, but you can read them on the list here. And again, while they are significant, it does require a sustained commitment to figuring out how to move forward despite the siting hurdles for facilities. Okay, and then this is really just in summary, supportive policies. Starting with what words we use and how we define terms, is it food scraps? Is it organics? Is it yucky food waste that we want people to handle? Thinking about those terms up front and using them in our outreach. We've seen some communities that have banned or restricted materials from disposal. Some of those come at the upfront. Some of them come after they've already got programs in place. I believe that local governments and state governments can do quite a bit to use policies to set new expectations and new norms and to get higher participation and results. EPA determined that greenhouse gases endanger human health. It found under Section 202A of the Clean Air Act that greenhouse gases threaten both the public health and the public welfare. That was this past year. Local governments got into the trash collection area about 100 years ago to protect public health and safety. Local governments now can justify recycling and composting, especially of otherwise landfill food waste that's releasing methane to the atmosphere. Local governments can justify the composting of that material as necessary to protect public health and well-being, I would argue. There's a number of other supportive policies that are listed here, and I'm going to wrap up by just saying that food scraps does represent an enormous opportunity for communities and generators, haulers, equipment dealers, and facility operators. And I would invite you to contact me after the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Sure, everyone appreciated that summary of all the decision-making points to setting up a composting program. Our next speaker is Jennifer Brady. She works in U.S. EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, which is formerly known as the Office of Solid Waste. Jennifer specializes in the measurement of waste generation and waste management. A large part of her work focuses on the estimation of greenhouse gas and energy benefits from recycling and composting. She also spends time helping states, localities, and businesses to properly properly use the waste reduction model known as WARM? Jennifer?
Hello. Glad to be back. I think I was on the first one of these, and now I will be here on the last one and the last speaker. And I think what I'm going to give you here today is maybe effectively your homework, because we are going to talk about tools, and we are going to talk about a couple of the tools that EPA offers for you to scope out whether or not let's say you can put together a program, the costs of putting together a program and some of the obstacles of putting together a program, and then some of the benefits of putting together a program. There are a lot of tools out there. I'm just going to focus on two of our EPA tools now, but I definitely encourage you to look at the wide variety of tools that are available. The tools I'm going to talk about are the Food Waste Calculator, which is a newer tool, so a lot of you may not have even heard about it yet, and it's available online at this very long address, which I'm going to keep on the screen for a couple slides so you can jot it down. You can also go to our EPA.gov Food Recovery, is the shorter name, and you can drill down and get into the Food Waste Calculator, and that is an Excel file. And then the Waste Reduction Model, which probably a lot of you have heard me talk about before, and I'm going to touch on that too because you can evaluate then the benefits of a program using the WARM model. So before you use the tools, and this is a question I often have, is what do I need to know before I go in and do this type of analysis? And really the most important data point you need when you use either of these tools is as much data as possible on the food you purchase, how much food is disposed, and all your other organic waste streams. We're focusing on food a bit here, but really knowing tonnages, pounds, knowing how much you generate and how much you even purchase at the front end, which I think a lot of people neglect to think about it, and kind of goes back to Steve's point about the hierarchy, and then that might impact the top of the hierarchy if you start thinking about how much you purchase also. That's really the only big data points you need. There's other useful information that you could also collect and can help, particularly with the Food Waste Calculator. If you know anything about your current hauling costs, that can be very helpful to have, including how your hauling costs are billed. Are they billed on a regular monthly basis? Are they billed by pull? Are they billed by weight? That's an important piece of information to know. Even if you're not using the tool, it's really good to have a handle on that. And then another useful piece of information to note before you start going in to use the tool are any fees that you have for dumpster rentals, bins, basically the equipment around your program. It's helpful to know. So these are the things that really, when you're going to sit down at your desk behind these tools, that you want to know. There's other questions that will be asked, but this is really going to get you started. So the Food Waste Calculator, as I mentioned, is a newer tool we put together. It's not an environmental benefits tool per se, though it does have some environmental benefits at the end. It's more of a tool to help you evaluate the costs of food waste disposal and the entire extent of the hierarchy. I think unlike a lot of tools, this actually starts with evaluating the costs and benefits of source reduction, of feeding people, of diverting to animal feed. So it's really going to show you a really broad set of options as far as food waste disposal and diversion. I should change it to food scraps. I always forget that. It allows users also to focus in on a particular type of institution. So if you're targeting grocery stores, if you're targeting schools, we even have prisons in there, which is find out is a big generator of food scraps. You can also select your institution, and that may help with defaults, too, if you don't know values. There are default assumptions available because we realize that not everyone has a completely extensive knowledge of all their programs, and so we do allow for some defaults, though obviously your conclusions are going to be much better if you're able to pull out your own data. And it also includes capital and operating and maintenance costs. So it's going to include the costs that are upfront to begin your program, which a lot of people find somewhat difficult, and then also as the program goes along. So it's important to acknowledge both of those elements of the program, the upfront costs that you're going to have from day one, and then what it's going to cost from year to year, and those may vary quite a bit. So I kind of cut and pasted the food waste calculator here to make it a little more readable. So when you're going to see it on the screen, it's going to appear different because I just tried to extract sections so I could help you get a little familiar with what it looks like. The food waste calculator functions on a set of basically input boxes and then questions on which more questions are then developed as you answer yes or no to certain questions. What I've shown here is the top of the calculator. And like I said, unlike a lot of calculators, we actually go right for the source reduction. And we'd like you to evaluate the costs and the benefits of source reducing first before you even think about dealing with those food scraps, maybe not even generating those food scraps. And as you can see from here, the first questions obviously go straight to how many pounds are you generating. So that's a big number you'll want to know. Again, we do have some defaults. So if you don't know, we asked some folks in the business, well, about how many pounds does a grocery store generate per week? And those can go in there. And I like everything we do here in EPA, I always like to say if there's someone out there who uses this calculator and sees our defaults and says, well, you know, I think I have better information, you feel free to call us and say, you know, these are some other defaults you might want to consider. We ask you here how much you want to reduce your waste, situation here would be probably your upfront purchasing because you're talking about source reduction. And then it asks you some different questions about the different streams. There we talk about yellow grease here, which is a little different than a lot of our EPA calculators where we don't really deal with the subject of yellow grease. It usually doesn't get grouped in, but here we have gone through that. We do have some costs per pound because, again, this is a cost calculator to get the cost savings for minimizing your waste. And you'll see these are the defaults here, the 1.17, the $1.17. Next, we go into non-perishable food. And like I said, this is just the top. And here you'll start to see the drop-downs. And let me see. I think I have in my next slide. It's just some more of the drop-downs, and we're going into now the pre-consumer. And you kind of just want to scan the kind of questions we ask you here. And as I said, a lot of these you don't really need data for. It's more you just need to know if something's available or not. And you may need to go back and look up if something is available to you or not. For example, near the top here, we say, is there a food rescue service that offers regular pickups? And another thing that I didn't highlight here, I kind of clipped off just to save some space, is we do have suggestions here and links. So, for example, with the food rescue service, we do have a link. I think it's to the Feeding America site. So if you're not sure about this question, you can then click through, and it'll link you to the Feeding America site, and you can investigate whether or not there is a local food bank that could maybe help you manage some of your food scraps that are still edible and it could still be utilized. And then you can see at the bottom here, we start getting into composting, which you've talked about a lot. And again, a bunch of yes-no questions here about composting and some monetary questions. And I think what I've showed you here is just a bit of how the model expands. Hopefully, a lot of data here, but hopefully it's somewhat clear. Basically, what I'm looking at here is the second question down. Are you willing to purchase and operate an in-vessel composter at your facility? And what I did was I said yes, and what happens then is the screen goes from the top screen. It adds a whole series of additional questions then about the in-vessel composter that you said you're willing to purchase. So then it asks about capital costs. It asks about energy costs. It even gets down into the financing options. So if you really go through and answer a lot of these questions, yes, your model becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and it gives you a lot more options. But the flip side is if you want to keep it simple, you really can, and you're not going to get all these additional options. So there's a lot of functionality to the model, and there's really a lot of information that can go into it. But for the most part, yes, no answers. The results, once you've gone through all the series of questions, all your yes, no questions, your tonnages, what you're going to get is you're going to get a cost calculator tab, and it's going to give you the 1 year, the 3 year, the 6 year, and the 10 year costs. And so that's going to include those capital costs and then the operating and maintenance costs throughout the year. It's going to give you a graphical representation of those costs, particularly useful probably if you need to present this to someone and try to sell them on why this is an effective program. And then there is a benefits tab that does give you several environmental benefits to the options you've chosen. You can see particulates, carcinogens. One thing I'll say is you don't see GHG here. What we did was we just said go to warm, so you'll hear about that later. It was just easier than kind of building it into the model here. So that one isn't included. We just kind of prompt you to go to the warm model if you want the GHG benefits. But you get a lot of information, and unlike I think a lot of our calculators you see coming out of the EPA in the past, this really does focus on the cost of the program and the benefits of having a diversion program and how it can be a cost-effective benefit. And here's then a results page, which is a real summary of the results tab that I just discussed. And at the very top, it's just a really direct, of these two options, this is your best food diversion strategy. And so you see for non-perishable food waste, based on the inputs we had put in, it says your best strategy is to use a food bank. For pre-consumer, the best strategy was food rescue. And I'll tell you, it's not rigged because I did it once and I got landfilling for every option. So I would not recommend whatever defaults I put into it. So there's a lot of different options can come out of the different food diversion strategies from here. And then beyond that is just a summary of a lot of the other elements that I talked about, the particulates, talks about the total tonnage you would be composting, talks about the monetary savings overall. So this is, again, a nice summary page. And I know after working for years with people with the warm, it's nice to have these too when you are going maybe to your city council, when you're going to your board of directors, whomever, and trying to present the results and say this is really an effective strategy for us to take. This is a kind of a nice summary of all those results all packaged into one. Okay, now we're going to get into warm a little bit, which I know I've talked about briefly on the first presentation, but I'm going to talk a little more, I think, on this one about actually using the model and plugging data into the model. It does estimate the climate and energy impacts of waste management. A lot of people forget there's energy impacts in there too, BTUs, because we do focus on the climate a lot. It can be used for decision making or estimating benefits of an existing program. So in that sense, it acts as a nice corollary to the food waste calculator in that you can use it to, at the beginning of the process, to help make your decision and say there's going to be a cost savings, for example, and there's also going to be an anticipated environmental GHG benefit. And then at the end, after you've actually implemented the program, you can go back and plug your numbers in again and find out what the actual benefit of your program is. And I'm finding that the model is really used a lot at the end of the program rather than decision making, but there's no reason it can't be used at both stages. And also if you're speculating on maybe increasing the program, the benefits of increasing tonnages. So I apologize for the tininess of this if it's a little tight. This is the Excel model interface. I often show the online model interface, but I decided to show the Excel model interface partly because in the coming months, we are going to be making some pretty drastic changes to the organic components of the model and allowing for a lot more options. And when that occurs, those options are going to be in the Excel version and not the online version. The online version is probably going to be a very scaled down basic version of the model, and the Excel model is going to be where you get to choose a lot of the options. So if a lot of folks listening today are going to be looking at organic components of the model, they're really going to want to start learning the Excel version because that's really where the meat of it all is going to be. So this is all the materials we have so far, and this is the whole primary interface screen that you get when you open the model. And this is it in total. And this is version 10, so this is the newest version. I kind of tried to zero in a little bit here on just part of the screen and basically just plugging in if you were managing 10 tons of food waste. And if you look at the line, it's second from the bottom there, I just put 10 in the landfilling, and I said, no, instead I'm going to compost 10, and I put 10 in the compost column. And it's really as simple as that. I think once you get to start running it, you realize it does become rather straightforward in that sense when all you're doing is putting in the two options. For some people, you may put combusted. That may be the alternate scenario if you're not composting. And obviously, you know, source reduction is another option. We don't include recycling for organics materials because we are basically having composting being your recycling option. And so that's not applicable for that category. And the tons generated in the center there is actually filled in for you. And just to give you an idea, this is the summary report then that you get from WARM. And this is the GHG benefits, and these here that I'm showing you, the metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, which tends to be the common language of GHG speak right now. And so what it's giving you is the emissions from the baseline management scenario, which would be landfilling the material, the emissions from the alternative management scenario, which would be composting the material, and then your total benefit, which is the benefit of not landfilling, plus the benefit of composting. And obviously the landfilling, most of that is methane emissions from the landfill, and the composting is a series of benefits from carbon storage, and so that's where your substantial benefit is for your compost. And in future iterations, there may be additional things that we're looking at to work into those benefits of composting, but I won't go too deep into that yet because we're still investigating that, but hopefully I'll be sharing a lot of that with you very soon. So I don't really have much more. Like I said, I just want to give you an introduction, but I encourage anyone who tries to run the model, has trouble with the WARM or the food waste calculator, to give me a call. Or for the food waste calculator, you can also call my coworker, Jean Schwab, and we can help you run through the models. And we're always open also, like I said, to default values that would be useful in the food waste calculator. It is a new model. And so we're very interested in seeing how people utilize it and what they find useful and what they find could be maybe helpful in future versions of it. And WARM, I'm always there to run through your examples with you, too, and help you explain the results. And like I said, with the WARM in particular, look for some big changes coming soon. So I think that's it. I think I kept it pretty brief there. There's my contact information. And thank you again for having me. And go home and do your homework.
Thanks, Jen. We'd like to start. This is Amy Wolfram again. We'd like to start the question and answer period now. Questions, as a reminder, can only be submitted via the Q&A feature at the top of your screen. It's the fourth tab in. If you could, if you have a question for a particular presenter, if you could put their name before the question, that would be great. I'll ask your question out loud. And any questions that are not answered today will be compiled and answered via email in the following weeks. And also, these presentations will be available online. So, Nora, the first question was for you, and the attendee was wondering whether urban settings where changing behavior might be too heavy of a lift to promote curbside composting without government buy-in, and whether it makes sense instead not to just source separate and to ship to a municipal solid waste location at a separate facility.
Am I able to view that? Because I don't. Real quick, is suggesting government mandate, or is it easier to not source separate and send off to a solid waste processing facility? Sorry.
Sure. They're asking if curbside composting without government buy-in, which I'm assuming means a subsidy or some kind of help, makes sense over source separation.
Okay. Typically, the source separation is part of that curbside collection program in municipalities, and there is no question on the residential side that having government support either through a public policy or some sort of a – let me put it this way. Almost every residential program, and maybe Steve might be able to think of one that isn't, is supported in some fashion by that municipal government, if at a minimum with a good public education and outreach, and that is for curbside collection. For the commercial stream, we're seeing that it is definitely not necessary to have that municipal support. But for residential, absolutely.
Okay. The next question is also for you. In communities where high volumes of food waste are being composted, is there enough demand for the end material? Is there enough of a market?
Sure. I think it's fair to say that there is more demand than supply for a good quality compost. The challenge can be with food waste composting, and really even just with yard trimmings composting, is potential contamination from plastic, I think, would be the primary contaminant. But assuming that the compost is processed correctly, meets all the time temperature requirements and stability, and there's not contamination, there is by far way more demand than supply in just about every area of the country. As long as there's a marketing initiative that goes with it, you can't just make it and let it sit there. You really do have to plug in, you know, and there's a whole school of how one starts up a marketing program, which if anybody's interested in some guidance on that, I could email me and I'll be happy to send you a few articles.
Great. Thank you. The next questions, I'm going to combine two questions, and they weren't necessarily addressed to a specific speaker, but I think a few of you could speak to it. So the question is, composted is touted as a way to reduce greenhouse gases, but composting also produces carbon gases. So how do you compare GHG emissions of 1 ton of organics that decomposes anaerobically in a landfill versus 1 ton of organics that decomposes in a composting system?
This is Jen. We really, right now, though this might change slightly, we find there are very minimal emissions from the composting process if properly done. Right now, we actually have zero emissions from that composting process. We may be adding a very small amount. There's also, and this is kind of maybe something that if someone's really interested in, we might want to get into a discussion on the side. There's also the discussion of anthropogenic versus biogenic emissions, and if it degrades in a natural, basically what's considered a natural process and doesn't produce methane but produces carbon, it's assumed that that would have happened anyway. So basically, if a plant falls to the ground and degrades on the ground, that's what would naturally happen even if we didn't. But when you put it in a landfill, it turns into methane, and that is considered an anthropogenic gas. It gets a little weird and convoluted. So some of those emissions basically don't count in the inventorying process. But I think the bigger point is really that we have found in good composting processes, there are very, very minimal emissions from that composting process that we're modeling. And so I think that's really the dominating factor of it all.
Okay. Thank you. Jennifer, another question for you is regarding one of your slides. What's the connection between food scraps and toxins, carcinogens, and particulates, et cetera?
You know, a lot of those, I mean, there are water impacts. There's a really a wide range of impacts, and I'm not completely 100% comfortable going into just, you know, my base of knowledge of all the different kind of environmental impacts and how they directly come. You know, I apologize for that. But there are a lot of water. A lot of those are related to water impacts in landfills, and so that's where a lot of that comes from. But sorry, I couldn't answer that with a more scientific clarity.
Okay, maybe this one will be an easier follow-up question for you. Does the food waste calculator that you discussed allow you to save inputs for future use and editing? And does it run from the EPA website or is it downloadable?
It is downloadable. It doesn't run from the website. It's an Excel file and it's downloadable. And in that sense, it's also savable. So yeah, I would definitely recommend that if you do a particular run, you would save it and save it under a particular file names. So then you can run the calculator again and do another run. But no, it's not online at all. It's completely desktop driven. Much easier.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
Nora, how do feedstocks compare between source-separated organics composting versus anaerobic digestion?
The starting feedstock can be the same. Traditionally, I'll speak just to the U.S. With what I'm about to say, most or all of the anaerobic digestion systems are wet digester systems. So in the case, for example, of San Francisco, there's a fair amount of pre-processing followed by a slurry type step that is needed to remove any, essentially it becomes a slurry, a very liquid thing, and then gets pumped into the digester. In Toronto, they use something called a hydrocyclone where uses water to separate, contaminants from organics, and that, too, is a wet system. But in Europe, and there's I'd say at least a half dozen vendors now in North America are marketing a dry fermentation technology for anaerobic digestion that can basically take food waste and yard trimmings in their form with, you know, the same type of contaminant removal and size reduction you would do with composting. And then essentially it gets contained. There is a need for some moisture, but it's essentially a high solids system. There are then a couple of systems that are sort of a combination. They are not a slurry, but they're also not a high solid. They're more like in the range of 30% solids, for example. What we're also seeing is introduction of technologies and installation of technologies ahead of wet digester systems to essentially pre-process and slurry that material. And we have written about some of those in the magazine that, again, I could direct people to.
Great. Thank you. And this is another follow-up question for you or anyone else would like to comment. The question is, composting of food residuals obviously requires huge amounts of carbon bulking agents. However, I have seen significant and potential competition in the Northeast for clean wood by the clean energy plants that burn wood biomass as fuel to make electricity, many of which are being developed with government funding. These plants consume large quantities of wood, and I worry that this will impact our ability to find affordable bulking agents for food residual composting and to sustain the landscaping industry. Any thoughts on this?
Oftentimes what we see is predominantly yard trimming, so that would be leaves as a primary mixture, if we're talking in the Northeast, primarily leaves, and then tree trimmings that would be ground up. So not whole logs necessarily or large quantities of dimensional lumber that gets processed or something. Those would be incidental to the municipal, within the municipal waste stream that would be diverted to the compost facility. Some of the biomass facilities that are being developed, as I understand it, are dealing with a lot of forestry slash. I'm sure there's additional types of facilities that are being built. The issue of the conflicts between various public environmental benefits is real. The competition for feedstock is definitely goes on, and certainly in certain communities. so I don't want to downplay that issue. But I do think that at least on the in most places there are a significant amount of traditional carbon-based materials that are within the solid waste stream that can be mixed with the food scraps.
This is Nora, and I'd just like to add that I think Steve is, you know, absolutely correct. However, in some regions, particularly the Northeast, which is where we're based, we do hear about competition for carbon feedstocks. And this has been, in part, I think it's a factor also of the economy, because with less home construction, there's less, you know, the whole system is there's a shortage all the way around for anybody using recycled wood. And so it's important to, you know, make sure, because, and you actually need carbon in order to compost these materials. It's a bit of irony in a few states there's this big push to overturn yard waste disposal bans. And, you know, one of the big concerns is these are also areas where they've really done a super job of setting up food waste, you know, source separation programs. And so, you know, this is definitely something to be aware of. And I know, that we have a paper being given next week at our conference where they have switched the kind of grinding equipment they use, in order to be able to process different, you know, less traditional forms of wood waste for composting. So it's that the question is definitely on target for the current climate.
Okay, that is all the time that we have for questions to be answered now. Questions that remain will be answered and posted, and I'm going to turn it over to Gary now.
Thanks, Amy. We had really good questions, so like Amy said, those will be addressed and sent to everyone for them to view. Thank you for participating in our last in a series of five webinars. Speakers, thank you very much. Your information was very informative and useful. I'd also like to thank Sherry Lawson and Amy Wolfram of ICF International for their logistical support throughout the webinars, and Shane Nelson of US EPA for helping to set up the webinars and for doing follow-up. And as you could see, you could email any questions to Shane, and he'll make sure to get them answered for us. So thank you to everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Speakers, if you could hold...